Time to finish up Leukonia Genesis now and then go on to the next chapter. I haven't talked yet about slide 12. I did finish slide 11 as I remembered, right? Okay. So slide 12 is about the control, more specifically the reciprocal control of these two opposite pathways, glycolysis and gluconeogenesis, right? They are functionally the reverse of each other, even though they're not actually the reverse in all steps, as we talked about. But since they are functionally the reverse of each other, it would make no sense to have them both turned on at the same time. And therefore, they are reciprocally controlled, meaning when one is turned on, the other is turned off, and vice versa. So, glycolysis is the left half of this, shown by the blue arrows. Gluconeogenesis is the right half, going upward instead of downward, shown by the brown arrows. And as we've already talked about several times, the important control points are right here at the top, the interconversion between glucose-6-phosphate and glucose-1,6-bisphosphate, catalyzed by what enzyme? Well, it depends on the pathway you're talking about, right? If you're talking about going from glucose-6-phosphate to glucose-1,6-bisphosphate, that's glycolysis, and therefore the enzyme that's important to control is phosphofructokinase, as it says here. But if you're going in the reverse direction in gluconeogenesis, from fructose-1,6-bisphosphate to fructose-6-phosphate, then you need to control the enzyme fructose-1,6-bisphosphatase of the gluconeogenic pathway. So the reciprocal control means that phosphofructokinase will be turned on in the same conditions under which fructose-1,6-bisphosphatase is going to be turned off, and vice versa. We see the things to the left and to the right of the arrows that actually exercise the control. In other words, the effector molecules that ramp up the activity of the enzyme or ramp down the activity of the enzyme. So the plus marks obviously are stimulators, right? They will cause the enzyme to work better. And notice what phosphofructokinase is sensitive to is AMP, for one thing. Now, why does that make sense? Why does a buildup of AMP stimulate phosphofructokinase? Right. AMP in abundance means that ATP is not in abundance because ATP has been spent, dephosphorylated, in order to make that AMP. In other words, high AMP means low energy charge. Therefore, the cell is in need of ATP. Therefore, it makes sense to go through glycolysis and hopefully after that, cellular respiration as well in order to make ATP to restore the energy charge. So phosphofructokinase is stimulated by buildup of AMP, but also it is stimulated by fructose-2,6-bisphosphate, which we talked about last time. Remember, it's not actually a player in either of these pathways. It's a molecule that's acting as an effector for both of these two enzymes, these opposite acting enzymes. But it comes from fructose-6-phosphate, remember. So if fructose-2,6-bisphosphate is produced, if it's in abundance, in other words, then that is going to strongly stimulate phosphofructokinase as well. Well, those two things do just the opposite effect on the opposite enzyme, the gluconeogenic enzyme, fructose-1,6-bisphosphatase. High AMP is going to impede the enzyme, and so is fructose-2,6-bisphosphate. Now, citrate, notice a buildup of citrate is also stimulatory for gluconeogenesis, whereas it's inhibitory for glycolysis. Citrate or citric acid in its acid form, deprotonated form is citrate. Where do we find that? In the Krebs cycle, otherwise called the citric acid cycle, or tricarboxylic acid cycle. Yeah, it's a Krebs cycle intermediate. Therefore, if it starts to build up, that's an indication that you don't really need the Krebs cycle at the moment, and you also have biosynthetic raw materials on hand. There's a couple reasons that you could run the Krebs cycle. One is for cellular respiration, but also it is a source for subunits that you build molecules out of. So when there's plenty of that on hand, that means you don't have to go through this process either. And therefore, you might as well run the reverse process, gluconeogenesis. Okay? The bottom two arrows operate on opposite enzymes again, but remember that pyruvate kinase, which is the final control enzyme in glycolysis, is opposed by not just one enzyme, but two enzymes in gluconeogenesis, pyruvate carboxylase and phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase. But still, you have reciprocal control. High ATP is going to inhibit the glycolytic pathway, which it should, right? High energy charge means you don't need glycolysis right now. And notice the acetyl-CoA here. Acetyl-coenzyme A, which we're going to talk more about in the next chapter, is going to ramp up the pyruvate carboxylase enzyme. In other words, it's going to turn on the gluconeogenic pathway. And that's for reasons that we'll get more into in the next chapter. But acetyl-CoA is a molecule that does several things. You probably know it from 181 only as a carrier of what's left of the fuel to the citric acid cycle. That's how I've described it in here so far as well. But coenzyme A can carry more than just acetyl. It can carry other acyl groups as well. And it's very involved in metabolism of lipids, of fatty acids. Not only the production of them, the synthesis of them, but also the degradation of them. All right, let's go to 13 now and look at an enzyme that is one protein but with two different domains on the same protein. And each domain has its own catalytic activity. So this qualifies this overall enzyme as a bifunctional enzyme. It actually is two enzymes in one. So there's a kinase domain and a phosphatase domain. Remember that those are general terms, but also remember that they are functionally opposites of each other. Kinases phosphorylate, phosphatases dephosphorylate. So this protein is not only two enzymes in one, but the two enzymes are opposite of each other in effect. So hopefully it makes sense to you that it should never be the case that they are both active at the same time, right? That would just be a futile waste of energy. You want one or the other domain to be activated, and that's exactly what happens on this thing. Let's look at the control of that in slide 14. There are several enzymes being represented here on this cartoon, so try to make sense of this. The bifunctional enzyme that we just looked at the ribbon model of in the previous slide is represented in the center of the screen by these two, by the circle and the ellipse joined together. That's all one bifunctional enzyme. But the PFK2 and the FBPase2 are the two domains that I just talked about. PFK2 is short for phosphofructokinase 2. Which is a totally different enzyme from phosphofructokinase. Okay, phosphofructokinase is, as we've discussed, the glycolytic enzyme. Phosphofructokinase 2 is the enzyme that's responsible for transforming fructose 6-phosphate into fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, okay, which is that side reaction. And it makes sense to call it a kinase because you're phosphorylating fructose 6-phosphate, which also has a phosphate on it already, to make it a doubly phosphorylated sugar. All right? FBPase2 stands for fructose bisphosphatase 2. Fructose bisphosphatase, working as a phosphatase, is going to dephosphorylate something, right? The thing it dephosphorylates is fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. So it does exactly the opposite job. It turns fructose 2,6-bisphosphate back into fructose 6-phosphate. Now, in the two slides ago, we just mentioned that fructose 2,6-bisphosphate is a strong signal in this reciprocal regulation of glycolysis and gluconeogenesis. If fructose 2,6-bisphosphate is present, that's going to strongly stimulate phosphofructokinase, right, which will turn on glycolysis. Everyone with me on that? Okay, well, that in order for that to happen, in order for fructose 2,6-bisphosphate to be produced, the PFK2, phosphofructokinase 2, domain of this bifunctional enzyme needs to be active, and the other part needs to be inactive. Well, this bifunctional enzyme toggles between which one of them is active by being phosphorylated itself. The bifunctional enzyme can either be phosphorylated or dephosphorylated, and that's going to involve still other enzymes, okay? So there is a kinase, and it's this one that is used for a lot of purposes, protein kinase A, which is involved in that adenylate cyclase, cyclic AMP cascade that is used for a lot of different things. Protein kinase A, though, one of the things that it's able to phosphorylate as a kinase is this bifunctional enzyme. If the bifunctional enzyme gets phosphorylated, that turns off the activity of PFK2, phosphofructokinase 2, which means it will turn off production of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. It will stop being made. Okay? What function does that serve? I mean, what will be the ultimate result of that? If you're not making fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, what's going to happen to glycolysis or gluconeogenesis? Right, turning on gluconeogenesis and turning off glycolysis, because fructose 2,6-bisphosphate stimulates glycolysis by stimulating phosphofructokinase. Okay? We see that happening here. On the right side, it is phosphorylated. The bifunctional enzyme is phosphorylated. So PFK2 is inactive. Fructose bisphosphatase 2 is active. Its job as a phosphatase is to take the phosphate off of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, turning it back into fructose 6-phosphate. Okay? That means there's no longer fructose 2,6-bisphosphate available to hook on to phosphofructokinase, turning it on. And that's why gluconeogenesis will work and glycolysis won't. Exactly the opposite happens if the phosphate on the bifunctional enzyme is removed. That removal of a phosphate requires a different enzyme, a phosphatase in its own right, called phosphoprotein phosphatase. It removes the phosphate from the bifunctional enzyme, and that switches it back into the configuration in which the phosphofructokinase 2 domain is working, and the fructose bisphosphatase is not working. When phosphofructokinase 2 is working, that means fructose 6-phosphate can get converted into fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, which operates as a strong signal to turn on phosphofructokinase in the glycolytic pathway. So glycolysis gets turned on and gluconeogenesis gets turned off. Okay? But you have two enzymes controlling the, in opposite ways, the bifunctional enzyme, which has two statuses, and which controls both of those pathways, glycolysis and gluconeogenesis, by controlling two enzymes within those pathways. So it is confusing, but if you go through it enough times, I think you can make sense of it. Any questions on it at this moment, though? Okay. I think 15 is the last slide on this chapter. And what we're looking at here is the functional relationship between gluconeogenesis in the liver and glycolysis in the muscles, as you see labeled. Muscles aren't always active, but when they are, glycolysis really operates to a great degree in skeletal muscles because you need the ATP, not just the ATP of glycolysis, but the much more ATP that can be produced by cellular respiration if you use the pyruvate that gets spit out. But in very high active situations, like I've said before, the demand for ATP in highly active muscles is going to be too much for the body's ability to keep up delivery of oxygen for, so that cellular respiration can meet the demands for that ATP. You just can't get oxygen to the muscles fast enough via pumping your heart, moving your blood around, and getting your lungs to operate enough to get oxygen into that blood. So the demand for oxygen exceeds the capacity to deliver that oxygen. In other words, temporarily the muscles go hypoxic, low level of oxygen. And therefore, that fork in the road at the end of glycolysis, which the cell would like to go down the cellular respiration path at, instead is forced to go down the fermentation path. And therefore, lactate builds up in the muscles, which can lead to a change in pH because it's lactic acid, right? It'll acidify the fluid, which is bad news. But luckily, there's the liver here to take up that the blood takes up the lactate from the muscles, delivers it to the liver. The liver takes in the lactate, and we've already discussed how lactate is a precursor for glucose if you run it through the gluconeogenic pathway, which is what the liver really does, right? The liver is the primary site for gluconeogenesis. So it will take this lactate, which in terms of cellular respiration is worthless, but still valuable fuel if you get it back into the form of glucose, and that's what the liver does. It runs gluconeogenesis. It has to spend some energy to do that, remember, because it's undoing glycolysis. But then that glucose can be put back into the blood, travel to the muscles, and be used for glycolysis to continue to make ATP. All right? By the way, this is part of why you have an oxygen debt, so-called oxygen debt. If you sprint, you know, you're running as fast as you can if you're sprinting. So that can't happen for very long. There's definitely a limit to how far any person can sprint. Your body will just shut down, right? But when you finally stop sprinting, during which you're breathing about as maximal, you're breathing maximally during sprinting. Once you stop, you can sit down and you're basically doing nothing. You have minimal activity at that point, but you don't just immediately go to breathing normal, right? You're still ventilating, you're huffing and puffing for a while after your muscles aren't doing anything. Well, what you're doing, that oxygen debt is really just the processing of all this lactate that's been built up. That requires some energy to get that lactate back into usable forms. And until that happens, then you're still going to need more oxygen than you would at rest. That's why it doesn't just immediately go down to normal breathing. All right, that's one short recording.